Just one thing before we do jump into today's show, and that is my Beyond the Game newsletter. Would you enjoy getting a short email from me every Friday that provides something to stoke your curiosity before the sporting weekend? Hundreds of parents, coaches, and community sport leaders subscribe to my free newsletter called Beyond the Game. Basically, it includes a short insight from me that I've been pondering during the week, a key finding from the latest research I've been reading, as well as a cool idea from one of the inspiring minds who come on this podcast. It's all designed to help you support your athletes to be the very best that they can be. So if that sounds fun, again, it's very short, just a little goodness before you dive into your busy weekend of sport. If you'd like to try it out, just head over to athletedevelopmentproject.com/newsletter. Type in your email and you'll get the very next one. Cool. Thanks for listening. Kia ora and welcome to the Athlete Development Show podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Harrison, sports scientist, coach, and researcher focused on the developing athlete. My conversation today is with Mike Hester. Mike works for New Zealand Rugby and is responsible for leading their approach to the evolution of the game at participation level. Prior to this role, Mike spent 28 years at the New Zealand Defence Force, where he worked as a career and talent manager. Mike is also a former FIFA referee and has officiated at the highest level at pinnacle events across the world, including the Beijing Olympic Games in 2008 and the FIFA World Cup in South Africa in 2010. On the show today, Mike shares some of the skills required for a referee to be at their best in emotionally volatile sporting environments and why investing into early stage referees is so important for the game of rugby. We also talk about the shift New Zealand Rugby is making from a game-centred approach to one that is more participant-centred. The work Mike is doing is challenging not only the foundations of New Zealand's national game, but also the fabric of the culture the game sits within. So please enjoy my conversation with Mike Hester. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Where I'd love to start is actually with a piece of work you engaged with AUT and one of our students. So it's pretty close to home to me. So I'd love for you to just share a little bit about what that piece of work was doing and some of the people that were involved.
So about 3 or 4 years ago, we recognised that we were having increasing challenges with the quality of experience for our referees. And referees deliver really important, vital part of the game in terms of keeping the game safe and fun and enjoyable, maintaining the integrity of competitions. But sadly, those numbers were starting to fall. And also, that cohort of referees was also experiencing real challenges in terms of the demands of rugby, the length of the season, more and more expectations. They were getting older as a group. And not overly well recognised for their efforts either. One of the few sports in this country, at a sort of mainstream sports, where officials are not largely financially recognised either. Not that that necessarily is the answer to everything, but certainly and compared to other sports, not recognised in that way. So finding it harder and harder to attract younger referees. As is the case in a lot of spaces in rugby, mindsets are really strong about things, and there were some really strong views about what the future needs of our referees would be, both today's generation but also the future generation. And so in light of that, we thought we probably should really do some deep dives into what our early career referees are telling us, because that's probably a good indicator of what the future is going to bring if there's going to be more of them. So coincidentally, we had a relationship with AUT who were interested in working to the space. They had a candidate, Javed Ali, who also was an Auckland rugby referee himself, been refereeing for about 10, 15 years by that stage, had really good experience on the grass, who was really keen to advance his PhD and contribute to this body work. So we asked him to have a look at what are the sort of preferences, motivations, interests of what early career referees would be looking for. And that work was done over the last 3 years, and that report and his thesis landed end of last year. And what that's really highlighted is, in a lot of ways, not unexpected around what those early career referees are looking for, but what it most importantly has signalled is a bit of a preview into the future of how we have to have a system that's going to be able to meet their needs. So that's the sort of cornerstone of a national referee plan that we're pulling together now to really look at providing better experience for referees so they can in turn provide a better experience for our players.
Yeah, a couple of questions. Like, why referees in the first place? Share a little bit about why that you see that as being a crucial cog in the wheel.
So a couple of reasons. One is we would love to see every game, whether it's an under-6 game or a president's game in this country, covered by a qualified, supported, valued referee, and ideally with assistant referees as well to really add to that level of support. Sadly, that's not the case. We are now sort of struggling to cover all of secondary school rugby, and the bulk of our participants, 50% of them, play under 13 and below, and we'll be lucky to see an official referee. And given that they're learning how to play, really challenging, because it means that they're learning how to play in a system where they're not actually being supported by necessarily a sort of fully qualified and accredited referee. They will have a coach who's done a sort of Small Blacks referees course, but the reality is that the coaches are there to coach, and you would probably prefer to be able to focus on that, and so to not be able to provide an independent person to referee those games is a real shame.
So that is that affecting the experience of the game? This is probably the first time we've talked about referees on the show, nearly 150 episodes. And it's curious to me that it hasn't come up before, of the importance of someone standing in the middle, providing some structure to the experience.
Well, the reality is that there's probably been a lot of evidence in the past there that it has been an issue, but whether we've probably chosen to respond to it or we've made it a priority is probably what's in question here. As far back as 2014, we did some research around what teenage boys were telling us about what they really enjoy or didn't enjoy so much about their rugby experience. And one of the strong themes that came through from that piece of work done by a research agency was the lack of qualified or in their eyes impartial referees was a major contributor to the poor experience they were having. And so their plea at that time through that piece of research was to improve the number and the quality of referees. We haven't, for a number of reasons, done much about that up until sort of about 2019. We recognised that was going to become an emerging problem for the game. I mean, you also need to put it into the context of we are a contact and collision sport, and so safety is really important to us. It's one of our major for the game, is a safer game, and referees are a real critical contributor to ensuring that it remains safe. So to not have games covered with qualified referees, obviously, just makes us a little bit vulnerable in that safety bit.
When you were talking to those teenagers, would they then dig into some of the nuance of that experience and the contact issue? Were games getting out of control? Was there a real issue with safety? Or they just felt unsafe on the field? Like, what exactly was going on in their experience?
So a number of things from what we can tell from that piece of work, which is a little bit old, but the reality is we think most likely would share the same views today,
right,
is that probably a lack of accuracy. So that's usually a key thing, is if referees are not accurate, and I know this from my own background and experience, is that if referees are not accurate, it creates a real sense of injustice for players. So a lack of accuracy, and if referees are not qualified or supported or enabled in terms of delivering good experiences that are accurate, then you're always going to have that kind of feedback. Yeah. Often the experiences that those players had would be, it was a parent that was standing in to referee, so also not necessarily someone of authority. It was sort of just a reluctant person to do the best they can with the whistle.
It's funny, it's really interesting. Like, I've just started coaching my 9-year-old in football, and like, young people have got this real sense of fairness. They talk to this idea all of the time, and so when these boys come off the field, the conversation will always go to something that the injustice that happened on the pitch. And then on the other side of that story, because we just have parents that are refereeing, and the parents will come to me prior to the game, and the one thing that they're most concerned about is the rules. Do I know the rules? Can I make sure that I'm sticking to them? Yet the boys are talking about not so much about the rules, but just making sure that it's an even, fair game. So is that coming through, that there's just there's an inequality coming through the refereeing of the game?
Yeah, so Certainly, that's what they were saying in 2014, and we think those things would remain today. We haven't seen any changes that we've made that would alter that. Interesting enough, Auckland Rugby did some work around a slightly different tact, but again, just talking to young participants about what they were looking for in the game, and of the things that they preferred most about their experiences in rugby was sort of the normal things, you know, compliments from the coach, playing minutes, playing all the positions, etc. But one of the other things they said was really important was making sure that all their mates got to play. Not just playing with their mates, but actually that they all got to have a go, not just got to stand on the sideline and watch them.
Right.
So that kind of sense of, you know, justice for all, you know, it does come through in a number of different quarters.
Yeah. And so what else from a refereeing point of view? Obviously this is an area you know really well, being close to home. And I'd love for you to share some of your personal experiences in the game of football as well, because I think that'll bring some colour. But what else is it about refereeing that you see as a crucial piece of the change that you're seeking to make?
So the focus at the moment from a rugby perspective is we want to retain more of our participants through better experiences. And we know that the refereeing component plays quite a big part in terms of the delivery of competitions. So we clearly need more of them, and we need more of them who are, you know, confident, capable and accurate. What we're seeing is a real growth area in the refereeing space is how we support sort of performance measurement. We've had coaches and coaching for referees in the past, but fundamentally, and again, I come from a football background where the system is just a little bit more evolved, fundamentally, referees have a job to do, so they have to perform against that job. That's what people expect them to do, is perform against the job enshrined in law. So where we've identified some gaps in this rugby sort of system is that there isn't actually any kind of performance measurement system in place. So a referee steps onto the field, does the job, but doesn't actually get any feedback about how well they did that job. They might be given some advice from a coach or through a process of, you know, what they could do to become better, but don't walk away with a strong sense of, like, did I do a good job today? Did I do a bad job? Because in many cases, referees can find themselves in the middle of controversy. It's the nature of the role. And often, they can be at their very best in controversial moments, and everyone thinks it's they had a bad performance because it was controversial. But the reality is they might have been at their very best dealing with a controversial matter, and it's always going to be controversial. So sometimes...
Depending on which side of the sideline you're on.
Absolutely. But the reality is there'll always be two views.
Yeah.
But the reality is it's about the image of the game. So actually, what's the right outcome for the,
right,
the image of the game? There'll always be two views about whether it's right or wrong. But the reality is that sort of sense of, did I do a good job? You know, did I perform against the standard? So in some matches, it can be controversial, but you've actually been at your very best, and you need to be told you're at your very best. And there might be other times when it's been controversial because you haven't performed, and you need to be told that as well.
Yeah, so is this the stuff that was coming through in Javid's research? I'm just thinking, you know, that the players will come into the huddle at the end of the game, and there's probably a bit of a discussion around performance. I'm not talking in the sense of being really critical or coming from the coach or vice versa, but just a conversation about how things went and what players might have done well and some of the areas that they could work on. And then the referees sort of over the other side of the field sort of picking up his bag and or her bag and walking off without so much of a conversation with anybody else. So is this what they're looking for? Like, do they want some sort of community around refereeing that they can belong to?
So they do have a community network for them. The Referees Association normally provides that. It's effectively referees clubs.
So that's regardless of the age that they're refereeing?
Yep. So they... Right. If they're an affiliated referee, they'll be part of effectively their referee club or referee association. So that provides that kind of soft ears, safe environment, sort of a community that you can go back to. But it is largely a very lonely job. You largely operate by yourself. You might, further up the grades, operate with assistant referees. So there's a little bit of support and someone to provide a bit of feedback, or you can bounce some things off, or you can get a bit of help. But for the bulk of our community, referees are operating independently, and it is quite a lonely experience, which is why they need to have, you know, very deliberate support wrapped around them, both in terms of, hey, did I do a good job today? You know, someone needs to tell me that. And also, how do I get better? Both horizontally, but also vertically. So horizontally in terms of, you know, delivering on the standards and the targets that have been set for the year, So, for example, this year we've got law constraints around, or a trial around tackle height, and so we need referees to be accurate. So they need to be supported around feedback with about whether they're doing that accurately or not. So that's sort of that horizontal development, you know, continuing to stay up with trends and targets, but also that vertical development as well. And that if they want to get better, they want to advance, you know, what do they need to do to get to the next level?
Do most referees have an eye on the higher levels of the game? Like, is that why they referee?
There are views that is what some choose to do it for. There's others that say that's completely the opposite. The short answer is that Javid's work identified that people wanted clarity on what the pathway looked like, whether it was horizontal or vertical. They wanted clarity on the expectations of them, so they knew what they were being asked to do, both, you know, week to week, month to month, year to year, at the various level in which they operate. So we don't have a pathway system in New Zealand at the moment for rugby referees. So there isn't a lot of clarity for a young referee. And I mean, when I say young, might be young in age or might be young in experience.
Sure.
But the reality is there's no clarity for them about how they get from A to Z if that's what they wanted to do. And for many of them, that may not be what they want to do. Or they might look at the expectations, you know, at the higher end and go, well, actually, that's not for me. I don't think I could ever do that. But at least they'd have the clarity of that. So they don't have that clarity at the moment. So that was a strong theme that came through in Javid's work, is around pathways, what does opportunities look like, and what are the expectations so people can, you know, walk into things with their eyes open.
Yeah, what are the types of people that are refereeing in rugby in those developmental levels? Like, you know, a referee going out there to referee a game of 12-year-olds or 14-year-olds. Like, who's showing up to want to be there and do that sort of role?
People from all sorts of walks of life, to be honest, usually have come from within the game, and that's typically the case for most sports,
right,
is that their referees come from within the game. So they're a retired player or a coach who's sort of not so interested in that commitment and wants to move into another space, or might be a young player who's been injured, who sees an opportunity or wants to stay involved. So one of the pieces of work that comes out of the plan is we have to provide better on-ramps for more people. So at the moment, there's a really deliberate effort around Wahine. So Maggie Cogger-Orr, she's one of our top female referees and one of our top referees in the country. She's working for NZR at the moment, and she's delivering some very specific Wahine with a whistle type programs, which is a really specific on-ramp or onboarding sort of process for females who want to get into refereeing. So we need to think more about what do those on-ramps look like for different walks of life, you know. They're not all just going to come from retired players. We have to cater for, you know, 15 and 16-year-olds, for example, who want to referee but actually haven't played much of the game. So how do we help them develop game sense as well as, you know, referee techniques?
Yeah, cool. So what are some of the things that you have in the wings around supporting referees from a development point of view? You know, to have that feedback that you mentioned earlier about, have I done a good job?
Yeah.
You know, what are the things I need to work on, etc.
So immediate priorities, once we've sort of finished consultation on our plan, which is ironically due today of all things, but so the priority sort of projects over the next 24 months are around, you know, getting real clarity on our pathway. So what does the national pathway look like? So for example, we have 26 provincial unions. All of them will have a system of some sort, but there's no national pathway that they can all clip into. So as a result, they've got nothing to anchor against in terms of how they support people from grassroots through to sort of premier rugby and for those that want to move into sort of aspirational pathways. The second piece of work is around those on-ramping programs. So Maggie's leading a piece around girls and women, but equally, you know, what does it look like for Māori and Pacifica? What does it look like for teenagers, those sort of those on-ramps? The third one is around what does our GROW, a sort of performance assessment and GROW program look like for referees? So how do we support them understanding whether they've done a good job? How can they do a better job? And also how can they advance? So what does that sort of one-to-one sort of system look like of supporting a referee against the performance expectations and what great coaching looks like for referees?
Cool.
And then the last one is around sort of match day experience. So increasing challenges for all sports around how officials are treated on match days, sideline behaviour, expectations, people losing perspective around things, not understanding that it's a human job and a human doing a human job.
Yeah, that last one's interesting. Perhaps we could dig into that a little bit in a sec. But The idea of the GROW model, I mean, that comes up in lots of different domains, but I'm curious as to whether you could talk to that a little bit from your personal experience. Like, is that something that you engaged with when you were refereeing The Beautiful Game?
Yeah, so just for the benefit of listeners, I guess, so I came into football refereeing sort of my late 20s, was picked up through New Zealand Football's sort of acceleration program, and moved through quickly into sort of the national ranks. And then I was an international referee for about 5 years, and was fortunate enough to referee around the globe in a number of pinnacle events. I was really fortunate, one, in that football has quite an evolved sort of performance measurement and coaching program for referees. And so New Zealand's been an adopter of that for some time, so it was well established here. And so I got really good support all the way through.
Was that always the goal, was to go to the highest possible level?
Yeah, for me it was, because I was a kid with aspiration when I was growing up. You know, I wanted to make it as a professional footballer. The reality, like most, is that I had more ambition than ability. And then I had a series of injuries which really curtailed any progress I could make.
But I'm assuming you had really good experiences in the game to want to then ref it? Or am I correct in that assumption?
No, absolutely did. So I had really good experiences, and I had really poor experiences impacted by my view of what referees were not doing or were not contributing. And ironically, I kind of felt the early 2000s, I think, I had a pause in my sort of football career where I had a period of time where I was not going to be around much. So I thought, well, maybe this would be a year to just take up refereeing and see if I could, you know, after many years of helping referees with their decisions, maybe I should go and make some. And to be honest, at the end of that year, I was really hooked. One, I could see opportunity to have a second career in the game. It seemed to really fit some of my own personality type, which is you kind of need to be able to rise above some of the noise and just keep making decisions and with a bit of clarity and protect the image of the game. I was a big fan of the game, so I had a really strong understanding of how the game worked. So my game sense was really good, and I'd been playing for 20-odd years, so I knew what it was like to be on the receiving end of bad tackles or bad decisions or bad situations. And so I thought, well, I've got some experience I can draw upon there.
And were those the things that you deemed a lot of the rest were getting wrong?
Well, what I recognised was, as I started to fall back down the grades, I was being exposed to more and more inexperienced or lower level referees. You know, that was the reality. Yeah. So I was like, so you're only getting good referees if you're at the very top. And I thought, well, this doesn't seem very right. You know, I could do just as good a job as that, you know. And so that was what sort of initially drove me to give it a go. And then within a year, I'd sort of picked up that, hey, I've actually got a big opportunity here. And I was motivated to really go for it. So I actually set a goal that I was going to try and, you know, make it to the World Cup, you know, 10 years before I did it. And then was fortunate enough to go and do it.
Yeah, cool. So where did you start out? Like, what stage of development, age, were you reffing when you first, you know, picked up a whistle?
So I was in my late 20s when I started. So kind of, I would say I was probably the last generation of retired player or retiring players that were picking up the whistle and then going on to have success. It's much harder today because the expectation is that you need to be able to officiate sort of at that top level for at least a decade. So to be able to perform at that level, you have to sort of work backwards from the fact that probably in your mid-40s, you're probably at peak of your powers, but you're also on your physical decline. So so you really need to be an international referee by the time you're 35. And so it's a good 10, 15 years of toil to get to that point. And we're getting a lot of younger referees in football now, which is what we don't have in rugby. So that's what we're trying to emulate.
Yeah, it's a pathway too. And I think some schools are starting to have that conversation more and more too, rather than necessarily participating in the game. Like, there seems to be some conversation around, well, how about your effort from the outset, right? Like, it's interesting.
Yeah, part of it is that there's a whole lot of really unique skill sets that you can develop. So I was fortunate in that I had 28 years in the Navy, so a lot of my military skill sets were easily transferable. So a lot of what I was been trained to do in uniform, I kind of took to the field and used the same techniques there, whereas a lot of people were learning sort of leadership or situational leadership skills through refereeing, and we initially bring them in, so their development probably was a little bit slower. Whereas once I'd worked out the techniques and how to apply law accurately and and could handle getting feedback and processing feedback, growth mindset. Once I'd gotten to that frame of mind around, you know, continuous growth, then my progress was a little bit more rapid.
Can you give me a sense for perhaps an example? Those were three big skill sets that you just threw at me. Situational leadership, and knowing how to apply law well. What does that look like? Give us an example on the pitch and perhaps what you need to do and the skill, the specific skills that you need to bring through an example.
So in a game, football, rugby were the same. Big numbers in football, 22 players on the field, usually motivated and really engaged coaches and coaching staff on the sideline, very close proximity. Lots of controlled aggression happening. And so lots of situations where you could penalise everything if you wanted, but the reality is that's not keeping a good flow and it's not protecting the image of the game. So your job is to try and keep the game as relatively hot as you can without it boiling over, because the more temperature there is in the game, the better it flows, the more activity there is, the more for people to engage in. But you've got to recognise when people are starting to lose control of themselves or the situation's getting out of control. So staying above that at all times is what's really key, and focusing on the critical few. So that's the thing that was probably really important. Like, there's lots happening around you, but actually what are the critical things that you really need to focus on in terms of who to control, what to control? So that was one of the skill sets that was really important. The second one is that referees actually, in all sports, have to make a lot of decisions, and they have to do it very quickly because it's a dynamic situation. And if you don't make decisions quickly, players lose confidence in you quickly because you seem unsure or slow to react or influenced by other voices. So particularly in football, rugby less so, but other sports see this as well. So if you're slow to act, then voices come in, then you appear to be acting or reacting to voices, not to decisions. So the cycle that you're going through when you're making your decisions is that you're observing what's happening. You're seeing pictures. You're seeing lots and lots of pictures all the time. You're having to freeze frame these pictures in your head. You have to interpret those pictures as to what they are, then analyze them against law, and then decide. And so this cycle that you're spinning through, you have to spin through the cycle very, very quickly, because that picture only stays there momentarily and then you move into another picture. And so that ability to keep making decisions or no decision is a skill set that you have to be comfortable with and not get hung up on, oh, I got that one wrong, and let that haunt you. You've got to move, let that go and move to the next decision, make the next decision the best decision you can and the next one the best decision you can. So that again is not uncommon in a military background, but with other backgrounds it'll be the same. Emergency services, policing, they're often having to make quite quick decisions based on pictures they see and accept they won't always get them right and just keep moving on.
How different, I mean, I love that analogy of keeping the situation hot without it boiling over. And I go back to even parents on the sideline of, I always think about sport as being this emotionally volatile situation where it's so easy to boil over, but at the same time, like, the reason that we're there is because we enjoy it being hot. Now, if sport was cold, then perhaps it wouldn't draw the people in like it does, and so there's a real fine line there, isn't there? But at the same time, you're talking about making really quick decisions. Like, how different to a player is that in your eyes? Because I mean, working with young players, it's the same idea as for them to be able to have the experience to see the things they need to see and then be very good at discerning,
yes,
making decisions.
And again, this is probably just opinion as opposed to qualified.
That's the beauty of the platform.
But but I think, and having been a player, a lot of it is developed over time through, you know, game experience and drills and coaching, etc., where it becomes really instinctive. So players are making a lot of decisions based on instinct. The coach most likely will have a game plan that they want them to fit into. Whether they can fit to that game plan is another matter, and that defines great players from good players, you know, or professionals from amateurs, is their ability to work to a system or a game plan. But largely everything is instinctive. And also, if you get it wrong, there's usually some form of backup, because you're playing in a team system. So, you know, you don't win that tackle, there might be some backup, or that you've disrupted it. In the refereeing space, because you have a job to do, it, which is around actually, you know, accurately apply the laws, there is a much higher sort of degree of expectation and also failure in that if you don't apply the laws, you're doing a disservice to the game. So as a lot in the refereeing space, you learn a lot about applying law, decision making. You also learn a lot about referee techniques. Those techniques over time become really instinctive. So positioning, signals, how to deal with situation, it all becomes instinctive. You don't have to think about it. So it preserves your mental capacity for focusing on seeing pictures. So a lot of it, like where you move, how you react to play, all of that should in time become really instinctive. If referees are having to think about that, usually it means they're not able to process the pictures.
The important moments, right? Yep. Where they're having to keep a close eye on not having things boil over. What was one of the things that, you know, in your journey as a ref, you really had to work hard on? I'm just curious, as like these examples can be really powerful if people are thinking about referees and helping them out. Like, what was something that you did really well? And at the same time, what was a big work on in your referee career?
I worked with a trio. So in the last sort of 3 or 4 years of my time, I was with two other assistant referees the whole time. So we became a really tight team. We knew each other well. We knew what our strengths and weaknesses were. So that was... And we prided ourselves on being a team that worked really hard on the things we could control. So we worked really hard on our fitness, because certainly at the professional level, being really fit was really important. The last 10 minutes of the game are the most important in most cases. That's when you're at your physical worst, particularly in some of the environments we operated in, which is, you know, we operate in Africa a lot and also the Pacific Islands and the Middle East, so really difficult conditions. So being fit was one thing we could control. We were really... worked hard on the things we could control around understanding law and applying law. So did a lot of research, all the material that was provided to us, spent a lot of time, you know, really trying to have a really good understanding of law and best practice and the trends. The things that really challenged me was that there was only so much access you could get to games of really high quality in this country. And that's just a reflection of where the system's at. It's a semi-pro amateur system here. I had a little bit of time on the A-League. I refereed in Oceania a bit. But what was really challenging in terms of growth was getting access to real high quality games. My European counterparts, who effectively I was working alongside, were doing 30 to 40 sort of Champions League or top Premier League in either, you know, Italy or England, you know, and just no comparison down this part of the world, given where the game's at. So that was really challenging, is trying to get access to more football. That was really demanding on a week-in, week-out basis. So it meant that when you did get an opportunity, you kind of really had to rise to the occasion, because it wasn't something you'd been exposed to sort of every week. The speed at which that football operates at as well is really frightening. So seeing pictures, so that goes back to that mental or that mental system of that cycle of, you know, observe, analyze, interpret, act. That you're under a lot of pressure getting through that decision making really quickly, because the pictures were moving a lot faster. So that was always really noticeable. So I had to really be at my best from a concentration perspective to see the pictures.
Did you have to prepare differently for a game that was really at the top versus your everyday?
The things that we did control were things like preparation. So we tried to prepare for every game the same way. So early in my career, I decided that I wanted to be an international referee. So whether it was a game locally, just in my local, in the city I was operating in, or I was doing a World Cup qualifier, the approach was exactly the same. Sometimes you had a bit more insight on the team, so you could do a little bit more research. But also, I was always really hesitant about over-preparing in terms of trying to predict what was going to happen, because to some degree it's not fair on the players and the team, so you kind of need to let it play out. I actually tried to see every match as sort of an open book and say, okay, let's see what the words, let's see what words would be written on the
Were there certain players? I mean, you just referred to not digging into assumptions too deeply, but were there certain players that if you knew you were going to have them in on your pitch, you were going to have to take more care or do some research prior to walking out?
There was a little bit. I mean, at some levels, you operate with the same players a lot of the time, so you build up relationships with them. Some are positive, some are not so positive. So you've you've got to be careful of your own biases around players, particularly that are challenging. They're not necessarily challenging towards you, but they're just challenging players. So they need to be given a fair chance. They need to either have the chance to earn or lose your trust in them, so to speak. So I always tried to give them a chance. And referees have all the weapons and all the ammunition. We have the whistle, we have the cards, we have the ability to remove them. We've got to be really careful with that power.
One of the big pieces of work that you're currently engaged in is the shift from game to participant-centred environments. So I think it'd be a good chance now to move into that idea. And you've mentioned that the referees are a crucial piece of that. So could you give us a bit of a sense of what that shift looks like and we can go from there?
So as we know, rugby's a really critical part of this country's DNA. For a lot of people in this country, it's really important. It enables us to have our mark on the globe in terms of our success as a nation, both with the All Blacks and the Black Ferns, remarkable records. And that is really off the back of a very small system over the last 150 years that's developed from small towns to provinces to national body. And as a result, there's a real strength in how the game's organically grown in this country. And the mindsets around the game are largely really positive, but in some cases they are a little bit still held back by, all roads lead to performance or all roads lead to black jerseys. When in reality, what we know from all the modern trends, all the evidence around how people want to engage in sport is that will be a motivating factor for some, but for a lot, their experience in the game is around really joyful moments. And those joyful moments could be down in your local club or in your local competition or competing for local honours or just simply engaging in the game, as a player or a coach or referee or a volunteer. Not everyone has an aspiration to go on to higher honours. So up until sort of 5 years ago, we would probably categorise our approach as being quite game-centred, which is rugby can be anything you want as long as it's 15-a-side, full field, tackle rugby, and all roads lead to black jerseys. That real high-performance, game-centred view, if that's what rugby is in this country. Whereas what we're trying to move to is a situation where we're much more participant-centred. I'll talk about the reasons why for that in a moment, but just to explain what we mean by that, a situation where we're trying to make the game fit the players, the people that want to engage in our game. And when we talk about the game, that can be a much broader offering of the game itself. So 15s will still remain really important. My own son wants to play 15s, and for him it's really important. But for others, 7s is important, 10s, beach rugby, contact variants, non-contact variants, playing touch rugby, which, albeit not part of our family, they're part of the Oval Ball family, so we have a relationship with them. For a lot of people, that's their connection to the game. And so what we want to do is, legitimise and normalise different ways of playing, which still preserve all those identities of rugby, things that make it unique compared to other oval ball sports, still gives people the experience of engaging in the game, but in a way that meets their needs. So why are we doing that? One is that is the common theme around the way the world's going around how people want to participate in sport, particularly formal sport, is that if you're not more customer centred, then it's inevitable you're going to lose numbers.
Is that the way it's always been? I'm just curious as to, culturally, if we go back 30, 40 years, if you were engaging with rugby, did you have this sort of entrenched belief that there's only one sort of pathway to Rome, as you referred to? Or were there plenty of people back then that if the game was more participant-focused, they would have engaged with it?
I'm not entirely sure, but I can remember rugby in school. So I played rugby in school alongside football, and there was always kind of a view that around what this leads to that. And I guess in those days, and I was in school 30 years ago, 34 years ago now, there was a lot less choice. There weren't a lot of options come winter time to play. You either played football, you played rugby, you might play hockey. There weren't typically a lot of choices in terms of team sport, or things to do in that play or active recreation space. Whereas today, I mean, I think there's 40 sanctioned sports now in schools for winter. You know, so there's a lot more choice. And so the challenge for rugby is how do we evolve alongside all of those other choices? Not in a way which is seen as necessarily competition, but there will be a degree of competition, but actually about cooperation and collaboration. How can we work together with other sports so actually everyone can get their fair share of their experience and we can maintain, you know, maintain the engagement of the game, but in a different way.
Yeah, how do you do that? I mean, that's the idea of more choice is just omnipresent in the lives of our kids now. And I always think about environments that are remarkable. You know, literally, they go and tell their mates about. Those are the environments that kids are going to come back to. And if you're not up to standard, then they're just going to go and find something else. Is that what you're seeing? And then how do you collaborate with other sports as opposed to constantly feel like you're going to lose your kids?
Yeah, so in terms of the second question, what's becoming quite common now is regions recognising the need to work together from a sporting perspective. So a number of different collectives starting to emerge where, so let's try to work together around seasonality, for example.
Sure.
Because seasonality is kind of the thing that kind of trips everybody up. Everyone's trying to do the right thing, but no one's coordinating with each other. So as a result, everyone's just sort of, it all just ends up being Saturday morning.
Yeah.
So good example of that at the moment is this year my son's under eights team is playing in a competition will only last 10 weeks. So only term two. Which creates the opportunity for us to provide another rugby offering in term three if we want, because it's still another 10 weeks of winter, or alternatively for those kids to be able to go and do something else. Now, the feedback we've had from parents has been really positive. It's only term two, they get 10 weeks of, they get 10 games, they'll have 1 hour of training a week, so 10 hours of training over the course of 10 weeks. We've had about 6 weeks of pre-season training. That's their rugby fix. You know, that sounds pretty attractive. Means that second half of winter, I'll be able to go and do some other things. You know, snowboarding, skiing, family holidays, enrol in another sport, etc. Where the collaboration is not quite there yet is that not all the other sports have necessarily provided those sort of seasons within a season opportunity. So that's the kind of big theme that we're pushing from a seasonality perspective. Is if we think of winter as a season, then you just end up with 26 weeks of one thing. But actually, if you think of seasons within a season, if we can get everybody on board with that, you can provide a whole lot more choice for kids.
Mm. What's the goal? Like, what would be that 10-week program? Like, how do you measure its success?
Ultimately, is whether or not the kids come back the following year into your sport. But also,
because that's the challenge, isn't it? Like, you've got 10 weeks to do something pretty special for them to want to come back the next time. Because on the table the following year, there's going to be a number of different options that they're going to be able to choose from, isn't it? And I think that's the fear of sports is 10 weeks? Wow, what? Like, how do we do it?
Yep, absolutely. And I can sense that fear even myself about, is that going to be enough to really get them back?
Yeah.
But the reality is, when we talk about the participant experience, so if we take, for example, these seven-year-olds, there's three things that make up their experience that it's either going to make it remarkable or not. What's the design of the game that they're playing? So this year we've made some changes to under-8s. So ironically, I'm having to eat my own dog food now as a parent of an under-8 child, as I'm having to play the competition format or the design of the game that I've actually set up for Small Blacks, because that's part of my portfolio. So this year they're playing on a quarter-sized field, 7v7, with the primary focus being on tackle and ball carry. By comparison, last year they would have been playing on a half-size field, 10 kids, so going from 7 to 10, which mean your squad would have been about 15. They would have had to, they would have been learning tackle and ball carry for the first time, but they also would have had to do scrum and line out. So all these systems and structures that we would have layered into those 7-year-olds' experiences, and for the coach to try and manage teaching all of these skill sets and all these structures and systems to kids.
So what happens when the ball goes out?
Now it's just a restart. So just a tap and pass.
Right.
So what the benefit there is that we know that it maximises minutes for kids around the things that really matter. Because
give me the ball, I want it in my hands.
The ball is power, so give me the ball. So they get more chances to get their hands on the ball. because of the smaller size field, there's a lot more engagement in tackling because there's a lot less space. You also don't see kids build up as much speed, so tackling becomes less challenging for those that are a little bit more, sort of growing in confidence. Particularly bigger children who can tend to be quite dominant in those early years because of the space. My own son is a 60-kilo 7-year-old, and so he can be a really dominant player on a big field. But on a smaller field, he actually has to learn more evasion skills, looking for space. He has to learn how to sidestep more.
Yeah, that's really cool.
All the things that we know are just really good for kids. So we're into our third game now. So the design of the game that they're playing seems to be meeting their needs. But the other two things that are really crucial are, what's the delivery? So in that case, we've only got 10 weeks of rugby this year. In previous years, we would have had 16, 18 weeks of rugby. So by the time we get to the end, they're absolutely sick of it. They've had so much rugby.
What are they sick of?
Every Saturday morning, having to turn up, having to go to training. They usually have a break in the middle with school holidays, so you make a lot of progress with them. You bring them back after school holidays. They're 7 years old, so they regress, so you have to start some new skills again, or the old skills are becoming new skills again. And actually kind of itching to do something else. You know, their focus is elsewhere by the stage. You'd rather be doing other things. So that's the delivery part. And then the third thing is really the environment. So what's the environment created by coaches, parents, by the club and the school? So we spend probably nearly as much time thinking about the environment in our team as we do about the actual way they play and what they learn. So we focus a lot on, for example, really celebrating when they got their jerseys, because that's their armour, their team naming. We had a big sort of competition about picking their team name. We link all of our acknowledgements of performance, so we don't have Player of the Day certificates. We have acknowledgements of things like best ball carry, best follow, best tackle, because they're the things we're working on in training and they're the things we're celebrating, so they're the things we acknowledge.
I love that so much, of tying incentives into the behaviours that you want to see more of. It's just such a simple idea, but something that we seem to forget about so easily. That's cool.
Even down to simple things like, we know that at this age group, so this is just one age group, but this age group, they will typically regress in terms of, after a couple of years of playing ripper rugby, they're forced to pass, because once you rip, you have to pass. So they actually start developing a sense of passing as part of the solution. But when you get into their first year of tackle, they regress, because now they've got the ball. They don't have to pass. No one's ripping them. No one can rip their tags. They don't have tags. So they have to be tackled. So what you get a lot of is, you know, running across the field and not passing the ball. So in order to ensure everyone gets an equal chance, we have to do things like have to write numbers on their hands so they all get we go in numerical order about who gets to restart. So everybody gets a chance to restart. So the dominant kids don't always get the ball every time. So again, just ensuring that they all get an opportunity to engage in the game.
Mm. Are you thinking about how you can evolve the game even further? And I know this is the word patience comes to mind, and we've spoken about that before, of how important it is to take your time when you're making what are essentially massive changes in a country where rugby is everything. But like, are you looking forward to a game where you don't need to write them on? Like the constraints of the game require kids to pass?
Yeah, so it's all age and stage appropriate, I think, around the right constraints to get the right outcomes. We're actually looking to remove as many constraints as we can so that kids have more autonomy, because we know that that's what they love, is when they get to make the decisions. It just always has to be age and stage appropriate. So that's why we removed a lot of the structures like scrum and line out. They don't get to make choices about those things. They don't get to contest them. But there are some situations where, as they maybe navigate through a phase, we just have to have some constraints just to get those outcomes for all the kids. But I think if we go back to, you know, my mental model in all of this is, the mental model we share in a lot of this is, what would they do in the playground? When they're designing the games of the playground, what would they do? If we take that child mentality about how they sort it out in the playground, we'd probably be a lot better off in terms of, you know, the experience we're giving to them on Saturdays.
Okay, so that's a really cool idea. So tell me some more things that come to mind or that have risen to the surface when you put that lens on. What happens in the playground? Like, what? Because it's interesting, because I think there's also a a part of child development that would be orientated more towards competition than collaboration sometimes in the playground, where all of a sudden status becomes something that they're searching for. And that's the tension where I think a lot about is how do you find the middle ground between competition and collaboration? And what is it that we're really looking for?
Practically speaking, some of the things we know that kids would do in the playground to get it right, which we need to replicate in terms of the formal design of the game, is often dimensions. Just simple things like dimensions. We use very, very crude dimensions to for age and stage. So up until 2 years ago, quarter field rugby wasn't even considered. We just had kids all playing half field, and then eventually they moved to full field.
Yeah.
So dimensions are really critical, and number of players. And we know that in the playground,
They'll play on an L shape. My kids and their cousins will play on an L shape in the backyard.
And they'll make rules up to accommodate that, or they'll adjust, they'll bring it in, or they'll make it bigger if they get too many kids. So these are some of the simple things that we can do from a design perspective.
We had a six-year-old down at our yearly camping trip, and we played a bit of backyard football. And this kid just loves the ball at his feet. And he showed up. He was only there for a day, but we had a couple of goals set out, small-sided game style stuff. And all he wanted to do was dribble through everybody and score goals. And as for a six-year-old, far out, he'd obviously been kicking the ball around the backyard plenty at home, just loved to play. But I've had a conversation with a couple of football coaches recently around, what is it that we want a six-year-old to be doing? Do we want the ball at the feet? Or do we want to create environments that force collaboration, like passing the ball? And so that's an example of how I see that tension. Like, what would they do in the playground? Do they pass? I don't know. I'm curious. Or do they want the ball in the hands and run through everybody? And what is it that we're trying to create at those... Like, when does the game become about collaborating in order to get through the opposition, as opposed to just have the ball in the hands? Sorry, that was a lot.
the most advanced from a rugby sense in the globe across the globe now is England, the RFU. Right. So they've taken what we developed in 2002, 2003, the Small Blacks development model. They've applied a lot more research to it. They have modified it based on research, testimony, observation. And so the model that they have for kids learning how to play rugby in England is now quite different to ours. It's scaffolded in a slightly different way. It's a lot more... it only introduces things at certain times from sort of those cognitive stages of development for kids. So staying smaller-sided for longer is kind of the main theme, because if kids cognitively don't understand the importance of working together because they can't process that, that's beyond them at the stage, then don't try to force it through game design or game constraint. Actually just allow them to flourish in environments where they can continue to do that, and then introduce the need to solve complex problems with solutions like sharing or working together when they're ready. So that's where we're moving to.
Right. Interesting.
From a change management perspective, because that's my job essentially, is to drive a change, I can't just take the RFMU model and just drop that straight into New Zealand
for
a number of reasons. Mm. One is that's always going to cause a lot of issues in the country where rugby is so important. But two, that's a model developed for their context. Context is everything. So we have to develop a model that works for us and then introduce it in a way that also is palatable, because changes that you don't bring your community along with are not very helpful. So a big focus is usually around focusing on the compass, not the clock. In our change management approach. So some of the changes we've made over Small Blacks, you know, 5 to 13 year old age bracket, they've all been staged so people can grandfather out in an appropriate way. So we've never made kids go backwards. So if they've been playing on a half field last year, and they'll continue to play on a half field this year, whereas some have decided to bring the changes in early. So, but we've never made children go backwards, because we know that that will be hard for them to accept.
Yeah, for sure. Is that an evolution? Like, are you doing the research? Are you getting the data back in to make sure that it's applicable to our context with the longer view in mind?
Yeah, so probably the key measure is we're doing these changes to retain more kids. So early signs are that we're seeing more kids being retained in those age groups where, you know, they've been impacted by the change the year before. So in 2020, we made our big, probably our biggest change for about 7,000 kids at under 11s. So under 11s up until that point, we're playing 15-a-side, full field tackle, all the systems and structures, all the constraints. So effectively the same system as an All Black or a Black Fern. And for 10-year-olds, that was quite a challenge. When once we knew a bit more about what 10-year-olds looked like, the RFU had done a lot of work in the space. And what they had done is they had actually scaffolded in that much later, like 14, 15 years old is when they moved to that stage. We were the only country in the world that was introducing 15-a-side full field rugby at that point for that age group. So in 2020, what we were seeing was a real dip at under 12s. So our hypothesis was they weren't having a great experience under 11s because of the design they were playing in, lack of compliments from the coach because the coach are now dealing with a lot more complexity and structures, bigger numbers. So why don't we just hold them in that space for another year? So we made that change in 2020, and despite COVID impacts, we saw numbers rise at under 12 compared to previous years. So retention of under 12s is a lot better, and that's continued, that thing. So that's been the first sort of glimmer of hope, is that it's working. Testimonial from coaches involved in those grades has been positive as well, in terms of less complexity, it's less structured, more one-on-one opportunity, so more coachable moments. And I know that myself, that's so critical when you're trying to help kids learn. You need to have more coachable moments. And if you've got lots of kids, it's really hard, particularly only 1 hour a week bit of time on the Saturday. So, you know, how can you make that experience, as you put it, remarkable? Well, you need to have, you know, better coach-player ratios. So those changes have certainly been really encouraging. So they're the ones we kind of celebrate.
Mm, yeah, I love it. I think that's one of the challenges with the 10 weeks instead of the nearly 20 is it's sort of the learning dilemma. It's the coachable dilemma of, when are the moments? Do we have enough moments to get alongside our players, to put our arms around them and to show them that, one, we care about them, and two, we can help them to evolve, core psychological needs of our kids. I'm conscious of time.
One thing you mentioned earlier is about contest. And so our definition of contest also needs to evolve around what we think it means as adults versus what kids think it means, or what it means for them. So our definition of contest, so when I talk about, you know, participants at the centre, three elements that need to be in harmony to provide a great experience: design of the game, the environment, and the way it's delivered to them. Delivery talks to the competition approach. So how's the competition structured? How long is it? When does it start? When does it finish? Its intensity? Who gets the best referees for each competition? Playing windows, fields, etc. So that delivery part's really crucial. And that's usually where competition regulations start to come in. And my team this year will have competition regulations, which will be very small because they play, it's not a competitive competition. They just play and that's fine. But further up the grades, that's when you start to see competition structures start to emerge, tables, semi-finals, finals, these sort of things. And this is where there's still some gaps in terms of what we think as adults are important for kids in terms of competition versus what the kids are telling us. My 7-year-olds want to compete. There's no doubt about that. But my view of that is their horizon around what competition looks like is really, I've got the ball, you don't have the ball, I'm going to beat you. If I win that, I won the competition. That's their horizon, I would suggest, of competition. Some parents or some influencers would say, well, we need to actually count the number of tries, and then we need to work out, did we get more tries than they did, and therefore how many points did we get, and then where were we on the table? And so that is competition, but it's not the competition that my 7-year-olds, I'd suggest, are probably engaged in. Now, that changes over time, but we often accelerate that very quickly, and often we'll layer in competition structures and outcomes probably a lot earlier than what kids are telling us is really important to them.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I think about that as, like, kids, the competition idea is much more transient to kids. Hmm. So it doesn't last very long.
Correct.
You know, absolutely. But they absolutely, they'll come off the field in our games and they'll talk about the goals. And then I'll throw some chocolate their way or something, and it's gone, right? So, and that's the bit that adults, because of the way that we our brains develop, and because of the worlds that we live in now, very much past and present orientated, and we forget about past and future, and we forget about the present. Yet we work so hard before and after the game to make sure it all works that we live in those worlds, don't we? I'm curious as to where you're going with the environment. Like, how do you support the evolution of a game around the environment? Because the other thing I've learned too is that we spend a lot of our time and effort thinking about the design of the game and the delivery mechanism. And I don't think we think much time at all about the environment. And so you're talking about spending time on jersey presentations, for example. So you have to create time and space and intention to do that. And so how do you build a system that promotes those types of ideas? Because at the heart of that is about belonging, in my mind. It's about being a part of something.
Yep.
It's about, you know, valuing the group, and feeling like regardless of what happens out on the field, I'm here because there's nowhere else I'd rather be with a group of people that are, you know, see the world the same as me. So, sorry, long story short, like what, how do you create a system that values the environment?
We've talked about referees in terms of their importance. The other group that's critically important here are coaches. It's not all on coaches, but coaches are a real key determinant in the retention of players through, you know, quality of experiences. So the mental model that we're starting to fold into a lot of our game development, coach education, etc., is this concept of FABS. Stands for fun, achievement, belonging, and safety. And these are sort of the critical elements that need to be, that need to underpin the environments you're creating for your players and your teams, the approaches you're taking to training, the approaches you're taking to pre-game, throughout the game, post-game, the influence that you're applying to your parents. So, for example, when I talk about, for example, some of the things I do with my under-8s team, I equally need to bring the parents on board with that as well, so that they understand and they can reinforce that. So I'm often saying messages to parents, to kids, but actually they're messages for parents about these are the things I really want you to reinforce. So when you see them do great things, you know, lots of effort or big improvement around their tackling, you know, reinforce that in that car ride home. If you're going to talk to them in the car ride home, or you're going to engage them, these are the things to reinforce. And so that's starting to become a real common theme in our coach education now. Is it's not just about the technical, you know, skills and drills and the tactics. It's also about this FABS model of, you know, how do you bring everybody together? And that is one of the things that's really unique about team sports over, you know, other sports, is that the opportunity to have this real sense of belonging to a big community, to be part of something bigger, where you're all working towards one thing. You come from different backgrounds, different, maybe have different views on things, but you're working towards one goal together. And rugby certainly is a critical mass sport. You know, brings a lot of that community kind of feeling together. So the coach really has to harness and leverage that sense of belonging.
And so what are you working towards? You know, like if we think about the tribes, the groups, you know, the people that come together in sport, usually that's got something to do with how we go out there on Saturday. And so are we still defining, you know, the vision as an outcome, or are you starting to think differently about that? Because that's the bit that I get, you know, tripped up on a little bit, as we're telling everyone that we shouldn't be focusing on the performance, but most of the time it's what we hang our hats on when we bring people together.
Yeah, so we are becoming increasingly interested in terms of how we, you know, define and measure the quality of the experience, and that sense of belonging, loyalty, or intention to re-engage in the game are starting to become really important markers. Harder in children's space, because you don't necessarily talking directly to the children.
Sure.
But they will influence their influences about whether they bring them back. But in that teenage and senior space, you know, really starting to unpack what does success look like for them, and then how do we double down on that? So at the moment, big focus in terms of that teenage space around how do we respond to those changing needs of those boys and girls, particularly as they go through, you know, what is probably the most tumultuous part of their lives in terms of change, 13 and 14 is not what 16 and 17 year olds look like, you know? And so how does rugby complement that, those stages? So ultimately it's about how people, you know, how do they value their engagement with the game, the performance aspect, particularly in the community area. You know, you're always going to have winners and losers, and you can have your best season in terms of quality of experience, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have had success on the field, and it can be the other way around as well, as you know. So really starting to define and measure what does that look like for our players, and retention's a big part of that. If, you know, we have a retention problem in rugby, that's our big issue. People are not having a great experience, so how do we improve that for them?
And with the coach education, or the pathway, or the amount of coaches that you've got out there that are engaging in some sort of PD or expected to do so, you know, in my experiences this year with football, the team didn't have a coach until 2 days before the first game. And I mean, it's only 10th grade, the boys are only 9, but that's where it starts. Like, you know, for a parent to step up to the sideline and understand how you create an environment that's going to retain kids, that's a fairly hard thing to do. I mean, I've been doing it for over a decade, and it's still a challenge for me.
Yeah, they're kind of the reluctant heroes, if you think of it like that. You know, begrudgingly will step forward, want to do a great job, usually time poor, don't always feel they have the technical, tactical confidence or confidence to do it, but we'll try and step forward. So we've been thinking at length about how do we support those coaches, because those with aspiration will be curious, motivated,
for sure.
Self-learners.
Yeah,
probably not. They need to be serviced and supported in a different way around opportunity and advancement, horizontal and vertical. But actually for the reluctant heroes, how do you support them? And so when we think about developing people, we're kind of getting into the space of thinking about, it's the 70-20-10 rule, you know, 10% formal education, 20% is around sort of supported conversation or working alongside someone, and then 70% learning on the job. And so we do a pretty good job in the 10% space, particularly around safety training and safety education.
Right. So you've got workshops or courses that you can push coaches to, and is there an expectation that they go and do their accreditation around rules of the game? Or I'm not sure how it works in rugby. Is that something that all of the reluctant heroes are doing?
They're obligated to do the 10% part, because that's sort of mandatory, and that's part of our safety assurance program. And 70% is without, it goes without saying, yeah, they're out there doing it. Where we're really starting to become curious is around how do we have a system that delivers on the 20%? So someone who can come alongside some of those reluctant heroes who don't really want any more education. They don't want to have to go to another course. They don't have to hear another presentation. They don't have to sit on another webinar. They just want to just do the job and get out of there. But how do they get supported with someone coming along somehow through a circles of influence approach to say, hey, you're doing a really good job here, but just think about perhaps designing training so there's less kids in lines, or maybe don't use four corners as a way to warm them up. Can we have a ball in there somehow? You know, or keep doing what you're doing. You're doing a great job. These kids will be back next year for sure.
Yeah.
So
I love this idea. I want to unpack it a little bit. Like, where are you up to? Like, what are
you
doing, and what does the future look like?
Piloting a program this year, so we're in development now for a program in that teenage boys space, because we have to pick somewhere to work. And so we know teenage boys at A level are not having a great experience for various reasons. So we've got a pilot happening this year where we'll be working to that 20%. With their coaches across the country, probably sort of 3 to 5 PUs, between 30 to 50 coaches as a pilot. And that's around actually supported conversations with coaches. So no more, you know, they've already done all the formal education and they're out there doing it with cones and balls, but who's going along to help them? Who's going along to tell them, hey, keep that up, you're doing a great job, or just think about this? Because that's actually where development occurs.
Yeah, 100%. That's how people learn.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the birdie on the shoulder effect, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's the kind of the missing piece in some areas which we're looking to close. If we have probably 2,000 to 3,000 teenage coaches out there, probably about 500 of them would be the reluctant heroes, would be our estimation. So how do we support them?
Yeah, that's super cool. Oh, well, watch the space. Perhaps we can get you back on and you can share some of your findings. Just a couple of questions now, I'd like to draw this one into a close. Is there anything that you've changed your mind on in the last 3 to 5 years that's really had an impact on your work?
I think what's been really encouraging has been the system's ability to accept change under, you know, disruptors like COVID. So there are things that I thought were going to take a lot longer to achieve, but COVID created a sense of urgency around the need for change, and so the communities have responded really positively. We dropped about 25,000 players per annum over the course of COVID from 2019 levels, and a lot of teams really struggled to get players on the park for various reasons. And we'd copied with pride this game format from the Welsh in 2019, not anticipating at all there was going to be a worldwide pandemic just around the corner, which would really drive the need for it. But basically this flexible game format where you could, while still competing for points, play under a modified version of rugby, which in this country was never considered viable. Like, if you turned up without front rowers, default the game, everybody goes home, lose right. points. To play a game for points without front rowers would... It's inconceivable. The Welsh had developed this village rugby concept called Game On, which I guess to their frustration is still just a nice poster at the moment, that they've had real trouble trying to integrate it into their system. But we just, our timing was impeccable in terms of adopting it, and then COVID came along, and then communities, whilst initially reluctant, really warmed to it, and now it's become just a way of playing for many communities, is particularly at the lower levels. And so it's designed to address defaults, you know, get defaults down to a near zero level, and it's certainly doing that. So that's been really encouraging, because some of those things I think, oh, we could end up with a pretty poster here, but nothing else. So it has sort of reinforced that, you know, with the right setup, the right change messages, the right environment, you can move change through. The system will respond to change. That's really encouraging.
Yeah, that's super interesting. It's like a need to get something in place soon after the disruption has happened. I think about all the people that got out during COVID and were physically active. You know, parks all of a sudden became, they were full again. And now we've all gone back to the way it was, trying to catch up essentially, which is a shame. But
yeah,
the fitness industry or the movement industry was just waiting for some sort of intervention there to get people. They were open to seeing things differently, but I don't think the right thing came along. Anyway, I digress a little bit, but yeah, that's an interesting idea. Mike, what is youth sport for?
It's really to ensure the country can thrive into the future. I mean, the value of sport, we often think about it being fun, but actually it's a lot more than that. I mean, it's joyful. You know, it's not fun losing, but you often have to lose in sport, and you can do so and it still be joyful.
What's the difference?
Well, you know, fun is a fleeting moment, right? Joy is something that's enduring, something that brings you back. I can still remember from my childhood days of playing sport or experiences in sport, which were like, just kept me bound to the game because they were joyful. It was some of the best moments of my life. But for a lot of people, there isn't a lot of joy in some other parts of their lives. And so for sport, that is their opportunity. And active people are productive people. They're probably more likely to be content than discontent. So, the value of sport, the resilience it creates for communities, all of these things sort of add up to the country's well-being. So sport's got a role to play in that. It's not going to be the only solution. But if sport leaders don't continue to evolve their sports, then, you know, we're going to become less relevant in terms of contributing to that sort of national health and national prosperity.
Awesome. Well, Mike, thanks for taking some time coming on the show and sharing some of the really exciting and awesome work that you're doing. Watch this space. I'm sure there's plenty to come out of it, and I look forward to reconnecting at some point and continuing the conversation.
Thanks for having me on.